This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. Rice that prevents blindness, tomatoes with fish genes. Examples of biotechnology still sound like science fiction, but the debate over its future has the ring of life or death. The industry says its genetically modified foods can make a huge difference for developing countries by ending famine and preventing malnutrition. Opponents warn of super weeds, mutant allergies, and corporate dominance of the food chain. In between the extremes of rhetoric, it's hard to find impartial information, especially for those who need it most, consumers. This hour, we'll explore the claims of virtue and villainy of biotechnology. What shaped your opinions on bioengineering? Do you feel well informed? And do you think there are enough good sources of information? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. With us to clear through the thickets of hype is Peter Pringle. He's the author of Food, Inc., Mendel to Monsanto, The Promises and Perils of the Biotech Harvest. And he joins us from Moscow. Thanks so much for joining us, Peter.
Sure. Hi. How are you?
Good. In the past few weeks, U.S. and Europe laid down new battle lines on the biotech issue, and those lines run straight through Africa. What's going on?
Well, basically what happened is that there is a difference of opinion between Europe and America on how to regulate these foods. America adheres to the substantial equivalence doctrine, which basically says that tomato is a tomato is a tomato, no matter how it's made, and you shouldn't worry about it. And the Europeans say, wait a minute, we hear that there might be something going wrong along the line if you introduce alien genes into genomes, and therefore perhaps we ought to look at this more carefully, and they have adopted something called the precautionary principle, which basically says if something might go wrong, then you must test it before you eat it. If you take that to Africa, the Americans, as a result of this, American farmers are losing lots of money because Europe says no to GM. Recently, if you remember, there's been a famine in southern Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and Zambia turned down U.S. aid because it was GM corn. Mm-hmm. So the Americans are now blaming Europeans for influencing the Africans to turn down GM corn.
And for those who are not familiar with the arguments here, GM is short for genetically modified food, and we'll be referring to it as GM a lot throughout the show. Let me ask you to sort of truth test for us this idea that biotechnology, and this is an idea that President Bush has advocated, that biotechnology is a solution to the food problem on the African continent. How real is that? How much of that is rhetoric?
Well, it could be, but we must remember that this is only a technology that is good as far as it goes, in the sense that one size does not fit all. So just because you produce something that increases output and wards off pests in America doesn't mean to say that's going to work in Africa. So the Africans have looked slightly askance at this and said, well, are you producing the thing that's a product which is going to be helpful to us? And the example always given is in Africa, there's a parasitic weed called Striga, and it inserts a sort of underground hypodermic into the roots of corn and sorghum, local staples, and sucks off water and nutrients. It destroys large percentages of the crop in sub-Saharan Africa. So a genetically modified defense against this is available, but the company has yet to develop it. That's in America. And the Africans are worried because they won't be able to afford what the companies in America are producing, even if they decide to sell it there.
Now, Africa is just the latest battleground in this biotech war. Can you give us a little quick history of how it all started and what some of the battle lines are here?
Well, it was my fellow compatriots, the British, I suppose, happily to blame here. They got very skittish about anything that was regulated by governments as something to put into their mouths after mad cow disease. And along came genetically modified foods. It looked okay in the first place, but then they looked at it again and they said, well, you know, maybe we ought to be slightly more careful about them, particularly in light of our mad cow disease experience. And so that quickly mushroomed into a huge row where the European Union said, we won't accept any more of these foods unless they are separated out and unless they are labeled. So that's basically where it stands. And the America would like to take Europe to the to a court of kind in the World Trade Organization and accuse it of restrictive practices.
What's the objection to labeling? What's wrong with saying?
Well, labeling is a problem because as most of those foods come from America, the grains are not separated in the American grain system. GM foods that come off one crop of one farmland and non-GM foods that come off another farmland are put into the same hopper, basically. And so separating them would be an expensive business.
And so the U.S. does not want
to separate them to label them, sorry.
And so the U.S. does not want to have that as a regulation on genetically modified
food. But that's the first, and of course there's another one which says, and President Bush has gone around saying it a lot, look, you know, as far as we're concerned, the science is sound. We've been eating these things for since 1996. Nobody's had a harmful reaction as yet. So why don't you just keep quiet and eat your cornflakes?
Well, you know, let's go over that. What foods are genetically modified? What are we eating that is genetically modified?
Oils from canola, rapeseed, that yellow flower that you see growing all over the place. From the corn point of view, anything that's turned into flour, taco shells being the infamous one, but cornflakes also, cake mixes, that type of thing.
And most people probably aren't necessarily aware of the fact that they're eating genetically modified food?
I think they're probably not. And although there's been an enormous amount of press about it, it's still, you know, genetically modified is this enormous mouthful to get your get your head around, if I can mix metaphors. And that's quite difficult. And of course, they're not labeled. So there's no choice, as it were, on the shelf in the supermarket.
And a lot of the genetically modified food is ultimately food that's fed to animals. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so on some level, is this one of these cases where, because the animals eat it, ultimately, if we eat the beef, that we get it that way?
I think by the time you've got through that, I mean, the argument of the companies is, look, you know, by the time it's a cake mix, any new gene that appeared in that product on the way to the cake has been either steamed out, ironed out, heated out, or whatever, and so it's not going to make any difference to you anyway.
All right, we're talking about the debate over genetically modified foods here on Talk of the Nation today. The number, if you'd like to join our discussion, is 1-800-989-8255, and we have a call from Zach, and he is in Batesville, Arkansas. Hi, Zach.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
My comment, let me preface this by saying I'm not an agricultural professional of any sort, and really everything I know about it is from a layman's point of view, except I have this one anecdotal story. We have an exchange student at Lyon College here in Batesville who is from Zambia, and we're her host family, and she was explaining what struck me as a really terrible situation in Zambia. And I'd like to quickly explain what she told me about it and then get your guest's comments.
Go ahead.
She said that they're having a terrible drought in Zambia at this point in time and that as much as a fifth of the population is in danger of starvation. Apparently, however, they do export a certain amount of agricultural products to France, which I understand you all were just talking about there. And according to her, the French government has told the Zambian government that if any of the American food aid is brought into their system, that on the off chance that somehow it will end up in France, they will not accept any more Zambian imports. Of course, she's outraged about this, and you know there are people who are going to die for, as far as I can tell, almost certainly, primarily something that's designed to protect French farmers from competition. And I thought I'd mention this, see if you'd heard of such a thing, and, you know, take it from there, I guess.
Let's see if we can get Peter Pringle to respond to your call, and thanks so much for asking us that, Zach.
Okay, Zach, I think there are two points here. One is that there is a genuine fear amongst African nations and all those who export to the European Union that if their crops are quote unquote contaminated by GM crops, then they might not be able to export them. In the case of Zambia, some corn is exported to the EU, but most of the cash crops, vegetable crops, which of course wouldn't be of importance here. The second point is that, yes, they did refuse the GM foods, but they have been able to, as I understand it, supplement their grain stocks with foods that are non-GM. So it is possible for countries to do this without having GM foods that come from the United States or indeed Argentina, another big GM producer. And those that is, and I think should be, the right of the nation involved.
Why are attitudes toward biotechnology so different in the United States and Europe?
So different where, sorry?
So difference between the United States and Europe. Why do they have such a different attitude towards the idea of genetically modified food? I mean, is it a cultural difference we're talking about?
Well, of course, the French would say it is. so would the Brits, actually. You know, there's this Jimmy Buffett song, "I Wish That Lunch Could Last Forever," which I've always thought was a wonderful song, but it's actually a European thought rather than an American thought.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, Americans don't lunch forever, but Europeans do, and they get very fussy about their food. So I think there is a cultural difference here. But I go back to the main reason, I think, why there was the reaction in Europe was the result of the BSE, the mad cow disease,
mm-hmm.
and the lack of confidence in government regulators to regulate new foods properly so that they weren't going to be harmful.
Yeah. It seems that for consumers, it's hard to get impartial information on all this. Would you agree with that?
Yes. When I set out on this book, it was hard to get impartial information. You can understand why. I mean, Greenpeace, on the one hand, and other green groups are wanting to point out the deficiencies in the regulatory system. But honestly, when they call it Frankenfoods, I have to back off from that and say, look, you know, these are no more Frankenfoods than a person who has a transplanted heart is Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you go to the companies, they'll say, we've done frightfully well in the last 4 or 5 years since 1996, when only a few million acres worldwide were planted with GM seeds. The acreage is now expanded to more than 120, 130 million. But if you look at that statement, it's still only a small portion, perhaps fewer than 2% of the total global cropland. And 99% of that total acreage was confined to only four countries, with the U.S. at 70%, Argentina 22%, Canada 6%, and China 3%. So actually the spread has been very rapid, but only in a small area.
Yeah, and to what extent are the European attitudes towards this sort of based in that fear of Frankenfood? I mean, that idea of Frankenfood.
It took off terrifically. The media in Britain in particular.
Peter, I'm going to interrupt you. It's my fault. We're going to have to take a short break here, and we will be continuing our discussion on the debate over genetically modified food. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about how consumers get their information on biotechnology. How informed are you about what you're eating? Is it difficult to find the information you want about biotechnology? If you have experience with this issue as a farmer, an aid worker, a scientist, give us a call. You're invited to join the discussion at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Peter Pringle. He's a journalist and author of the new book, Food Inc. And let's take a call now from John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, John.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. I think that as a consumer, I might have other reasons than health to not want to buy genetically modified food. And for people to not tell me what I'm buying seems unfair. I might not want to buy it for environmental reasons. I might not want to buy it just because I think it's wrong to genetically modify things. I might have other reasons, and it just seems so paternalistic to not even tell me what I'm getting. That's very unfair.
Peter?
I'm sorry, for who not to tell you?
For, I think, manufacturers, for the government
right.
to allow manufacturers
yeah.
to not tell me.
Yeah.
It just seems like I should have a right to know.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And I would sway, I am a European, obviously, but I would sway towards the precautionary principle on this. And I would also I also think that the consumer has a right to have it labeled. I believe, actually, that it will be labeled in time, within the next sort of several years, and the manufacturers will eat the cost, as it were. And it may be that, these foods will become cheaper in the long run, and market forces will take their play, and everybody will end up buying them. But right now, I think that the case has been made very strongly that they should be labeled.
Thanks for your call, John. Peter, this sort of speaks to an underlying issue here, which is people's discomfort with the idea of genetically modified food and the belief, even if it's not proven, that it's unhealthy or there may be something in it that's bad for them. And is that necessarily true all the time?
The manufacturers say, look at the record. We've been eating these things since 1996 and nobody's really... nobody, in fact, has been harmed by them. But that doesn't mean to say that when you take a gene from one species and put it into another species, that something can't go wrong. And the things that can go wrong and the things that people should be still worried about, it seems to me, are the possibility of allergies and the possibility that somehow the genes would end up in a place where they weren't intended to end up and produce something that they weren't intended to produce. The only way around this, and this is, I don't see that this is a great, in terms of human safety, I don't think this is a great concern, but it is a concern if the regulation, government regulation, is not as stern and stiff as it should be. And I believe it isn't, and I believe that a lot of it needs another look. We should take another look at that. In particular, the tests are made by the companies themselves under the present regulations in the United States, and I think they should be also made by the regulating agencies such as the FDA and the EPA.
All right, let's take another call from Juan. He's in Hollywood, Florida. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. I think that genetically modified foods, they are, good as long as they're regulated by a government body, just as mentioned, and, moderated, because too much isn't good.
Okay. Thanks very much. I think that's basically what we've been talking about here, that we're talking about the need, I think, for regulations. You were saying before, Peter, that you think it's going to get to the point where the idea of labeling this food will be accepted.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, grocery manufacturers love to have their brands out there, and they think that if you put something on them which, is basically a skull and crossbones, then they're going to lose their brand position, et cetera, et cetera. But, they might also lose it if enough customers decide that they don't want to buy any cornflakes at all if it's not labeled. But as I said, market forces could prevail if it's true what the manufacturers say, that in the end it'll be cheaper for farmers to produce these because they'll be spending less money on fertilizers and pesticides.
All right, we're talking about the debate over genetically modified food. If you'd like to join our discussion, call 1-800-989-8255 or send us an email at totn at npr.org. And joining us now from Wimbledon, North Dakota, is State Representative Philip Mueller. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on today, Lynn.
Now, two sessions ago, you introduced a bill in the North Dakota House to slow the launch of a bioengineered strain of wheat that's known as Roundup Ready Wheat. Can you explain what the debate over Roundup Ready Wheat is about and why you introduced this bill?
Oh, I'd be glad to. The whole issue had to do with market acceptance, and I'm enjoying Peter's commentary on some of the other issues involved. But basically, the motivating factors or the driving force behind the introduction of that particular piece of legislation that you refer to had to do with our foreign customers not wanting genetically modified wheat, in this case Roundup Ready Wheat. We have the state, and I'm one of those producers, produces about 50% of the hard red spring wheat that's produced in the United States of America, and about 50% of that, of our product here out of North Dakota, finds its way into the foreign markets. And we've been told and are continuing to be told in no uncertain terms that a number of those major wheat importing countries do not want genetically modified wheat.
Now, is this the first time that farmers in your state have been not been receptive to biotech crops?
Well, I think it's important to make a distinction here, Lynn. I don't think the farmers, and again, I hope I represent at least a good share of them, are not opposed to biotechnology in any way, shape, or form. We've moved into the 21st century based on technology in all its forms. I don't farm with horses anymore. I farm with, you know, four-wheel drive tractors, and that's important that we do make those make progress with technology and all those things that technology represents, including the development of good strains of wheat and corn and soybeans and whatever it might be. I think, again, my major issue to do with genetically modified was the fact that my customers didn't want it. And, you know, I referenced the European Union and Japan and Korea. They have just, again, point blank indicated they will not accept genetically modified wheat. And, in fact, if we start in our country, if it is released for commercialization, they'll just stop buying from the United States farmer altogether. And I'm quite averse to that idea.
Yeah. And how hot is this issue for farmers in your state?
Well, it was two sessions ago that I actually introduced that bill, and it was an exceedingly controversial bill. It did just about find its way through the system in the State House here in North Dakota. Some factors came to play that prevented that from happening, but there were a number of similar initiatives brought forth in this past legislative session, none of which ended up in their final forms as legislative law here in the state either. And, you know, it's become something of a political hot potato, if you will, and I'm not sure I can explain to you why all the reasons, what are all the reasons that go into that. And certainly those who are advocates of technology, I can very much appreciate a lot of the positions that they're taking. Again, I go back to if you produce something and don't have a market for it, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to produce it.
Well, how are the biotech companies, in this case it's Monsanto, how has Monsanto responded to the concerns that are being raised about this
for
farmers?
Well, I think, that's a good point, Lynn. I think that the Monsanto folks in particular, who are, you know, are kind of the front runners in this whole transgenic issue, have responded with, you know, we're not going to do this until the markets are ready, by whose determination, I'm not sure. But they've also indicated they won't introduce commercialize Roundup wheat in the United States until it's done in Canada. Of course, Canada being a very major competitor of ours. So I think that, you know, the fact that we did get on their radar screen they did hear some concerns that wheat producers across the country, in particular North Dakota, have about the whole thing, and so they have formulated some committees, and, you know, I hope and pray that they do what it is that they say they're going to do and be very responsible corporate citizens and don't do some very negative things to the hard red spring wheat market.
Well, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed your program.
Good. Philip Mueller is a Democratic state representative in North Dakota. He spoke with us by phone from Wimbledon, North Dakota. Peter Pringle, that's a really interesting example of how this debate makes its way from across the Atlantic and out into the wheat fields of America's West. Here the farmers are saying they're not objecting to it because it's genetically modified. They're objecting to it because they won't be able to sell it.
That's right. And right now, I think the corn growers in the Midwest are lacking some $200 million a year sales in Europe. And so they don't want to be in a position, as Representative Mueller said, of having the same problem with wheat. But what it actually means, which is quite interesting, is that the biotech revolution is kind of stalled at this point. What had taken off very quickly in America and Argentina has actually got to the point where, well, if you can't, there's no point in planting these seeds if you can't sell the crop.
Hmm.
So the question is, where do they go from there? And it does seem to me that actually in the last year, Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta and the other big seed companies are actually taking steps to find out what they really can do, have changed their tune a little bit, perhaps not very much, and perhaps not as much as most people would like, to consider, you know, where exactly, what's really appropriate. In other words, is it really appropriate to produce these foods for certain markets, in certain agricultural climates, in certain soils, rather than the one-size-fits-all thing, which obviously it doesn't and hasn't. Let's consider what's appropriate and what's not. And if we have to row back on the idea that it's going to solve everybody's food problem, then let's actually come out and say so. And I believe it doesn't, so I think they should say so and just be more realistic about it. And then I think you'll get greater consumer acceptance.
All right, let's take a call now from Chris in Syracuse, New York. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks, Lynn.
Go ahead.
I just have a question about, how do we know whether or not there are any effects so far from GM foods? Because, you know, naturally these things can be subtle, might take a while to appear, you know, in the medical, environment. And I'm wondering, I mean, the opportunity is great for there to be some studies since GM foods have been in wide, you know, use in the United States so far and not in Europe, or at least I forget whether they've been in use at all in Europe. But anyway, you know, are there any studies about that, in progress or done so far?
I guess the best study is, 7 years or whatever it is without anybody falling ill from eating them.
But do we really know?
That's not to say that, we know everything about them. And it's not to say that we should be complacent about it.
Right.
But
people might have fallen ill and not have been diagnosed from, some subtle, chemical, and it would be a minor piece of the population, who's genetically disposed, predisposed to responding to some GM food. But, we've evolved to eat natural foods, and so then, creating a change. I mean, we know, what can happen. We're finding, new information on mysteries about clones and stuff. And, we know that when we dabble with nature, it doesn't, provide the most desirable results all the time because it, it evolved and metamorphosed into something that was stable and sustainable over millions of years.
Thanks for your call, Chris. I'm going to ask Peter to respond. I mean, I think that Chris is expressing that fear that people have about somebody tampering with their food in some biological, in some genetic way. It's that Frankenfood idea that has people so spooked out about this, whether it's justified or not. Right, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the only way to answer this question is basically to look at the record thus far, to say also that even the most self-serving, and I use that in a way not to denigrate the green groups, but sometimes they are self-serving on this. And Frankenfoods is a self-serving term in view.
Peter Pringle is the author of Food, Inc., and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Peter, we have been hearing about people saying, well, we want the companies to label this, and, you know, we feel that companies need to be more honest. Going to this idea of how people are afraid of this, is there pressure on the environmental groups, or what's the responsibility of environmental groups to present this in a balanced kind of way, or to give people the best information about this that they can?
Well, I think the responsibility is equally on the shoulders of the companies and their environmental groups. I mean, you know, the public has to decide whether they are prepared to go ahead with this technology or not, and they will decide by whether they eat it or not. If there are good parts of it, then we should point up those good parts. If there are parts that we should worry about, then we should point them up. But we should try and do it in a way that's not hysterical, not dramatic, not over-propagandized from one side or another. This is an incredibly difficult task. And, you know, nothing could be more emotional than food. It's just...
Yeah. And you say at the conclusion of your book, as a matter of fact, that that the only thing that's going to save biotechnology is public involvement in the issue.
Yeah, I mean, we must worry about the things which are genuine concerns, and we must encourage those things which are also genuine promises. There's scientific creations which are full, in my view, of both promise and potential hazard. So experimental foods deserve respect from those who discover them. Call for caution. More caution than we've had already from those who regulate them and grow them. And finally, at the end of that real food chain, demand the close study by those of us who eat them.
Do you have any sense from the research in your book who consumers trust the most, the industry or the environmental groups?
It's divided across the Atlantic. There's a very low confidence in Europe and a slightly higher confidence in America. But, you know, you can have a little scare here or there, like they had in the taco shells where some GM pollen came into the corn that was used in taco shells and was not regulated properly by the EPA. So that kind of thing can put a blip on the screen. But basically, Europeans, more than 50% of Europeans are against it and under 50% of Americans.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Here are some of today's NPR News headlines. Today was the inaugural meeting of Baghdad's new municipal council. The members were selected by U.S. officials to advise the chief American administrator, Paul Bremer. NPR's Deborah Amos will have that report from Iraq. And All Things Considered interviews National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice about potential U.S. peacekeeping in Liberia and about U.S. efforts in Iraq. Tomorrow, a session-end review of the Supreme Court with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Today, we're talking about the global debate over biotechnology with our guest, Peter Pringle. He's the author of Food, Inc. Peter, an email question here. Do genetic modifications ever occur naturally in agricultural plants?
depends what you mean by naturally. The difference basically between traditional breeding, where a farmer allows or organizes some pollen from one plant to go to another plant and then produces a plant which is a next generation plant which is different, you could say that was natural pollination, although directed by man, I suppose. Genetically modified plants, of course, you take a separate gene and out of one plant and put it into another where it hasn't been before. So there's that difference. And then, genetic modification is going on all the time in sexual reproduction in plants, just as it is in humans.
Huh. And let's take just one more call, and then we're going to let you go, Peter. Thomas in Long Island, on Long Island, New York. Hello, Thomas.
Hi, Lynn. How are you doing today?
Good.
Mr. Pringle pretty much answered or bounced around the question I had. I didn't want to slow down the program by going to such a simple question, but I keep hearing you throw around the term GM and that it's biotechnologies, but is it actual like any type of synthetic qualities being put into the plants or the seeds themselves, or is it actual just natural genes and just crossbreeding them somehow in a dish? Is there anything really bio about it other than the fact that it's just taking nature and adding it to something else that's natural? Or is it like DDT that was used years ago and then we found out, oh my gosh, this is killing us?
No, it's you're taking genes out of one plant and putting them into the other, basically. And the classic one is taking daffodil genes and putting them into rice and making that rice go yellow, the famous golden rice, and then making it produce vitamin A once it's eaten in the body. It sounds a long stretch. You know, why are we using daffodil genes when maybe we could make rice do it on its own? And that's a very good question, which we'll only find out in the years to come.
All right, thanks for your call, Thomas. And I guess just for a final question, I mean, this technology is here to stay. It's not something that we can just walk away from or ignore. It's something that we have to find a way to deal with between the United States and Europe and our differences over trade and our differences over our opinions about whether this is a good thing or not. But we can't just ignore it. It's here to stay.
That's right. We can't just ignore it. And the real question is, can we find the most appropriate way to use it? It probably isn't the way that the companies want. It probably isn't the way that Greenpeace want. But somewhere in the middle there's a middle-of-the-road way, which I've tried to find, even being warned that in the middle of the road there are only yellow lions and dead armadillos. But I've tried.
And I know it's the middle of the night for you there in Moscow, so I thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, and I know you're very tired, so I'm going to let you go now.
Thanks. My pleasure, Lynn.
We've been talking with Peter Pringle. He's the author of Food Inc., Mendel to Monsanto, The Promises and Perils of the Biotech Harvest. He joined us from Moscow.